This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Education got hit with some fake news.
Fun,
yeah, something.
In quotation marks.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Alyssa Schwenk of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming our special guest of the week, the 11 of Education Reform, Anne Hyslop.
That's pretty
good. Thanks, Alyssa.
Nice to have you here.
I appreciate that. You'll have to explain the Stranger Things reference
to me. But you knew
later.
It was a Stranger Things reference, so you're doing okay.
I'm getting there. I need to catch up on my Netflix.
It's a pretty good show. We're also joined by Brandon Wright of the Fordham Institute.
I don't have a Stranger Things name, but yes, I've seen both seasons.
Okay, well, you can be like...
The first one's a lot better, in my opinion.
See, I liked the second one.
And really?
Yes, I have a lot of feelings on this. I'm happy to debate
opinion.
It. I don't think it is, but I have been told that this is not the pop culture podcast, nor is it the sportsing podcast, which it normally is when Mike Petrilli is here, which
that's
he is
true.
Not today. But yes, you can be the Dustin or the Mike or Steve. I like Steve.
Steve got much better this season.
Steve got a lot better, and his hair is still great. And you have pretty good hair, too.
Thank you.
You can be Steve.
It's not as long as Steve.
Like, it's full-on 80s
so
mullet
hair.
Style. Yeah, but anyways, Anne, you are... In addition to being 11, who has superpowers, by the way, so she's the cool one. You are an education policy analyst, you're a writer, you're now consulting, you are name brand Anne Hyslop, and you are formerly of the Department of Education. So we are thrilled to have you on.
I am, yeah, and there's nothing happening in federal policy
nothing.
These days.
Nothing.
No
U.S.
news.
Department of Ed news. It's pretty quiet. Crickets.
Real or fake.
In D.C., so...
So we can talk about the Stranger Things instead of education policy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's pop culture day on the pod.
Ah, I wish, but we're going to get to all of that and more on this week's Ed Reform Update. And we're back with Ed Reform Update. We've got Brandon and Anne. And, you know, when we kind of started tossing around topics this week, we started with this Politico profile, which we're going to get to in a second, of Betsy DeVos 10 months into her tenure as Secretary of Education. But then this week, something fun happened, and education got hit with some fake news.
Fun,
yeah, something.
In quotation marks, maybe.
In quotation marks.
Who knew that a single quote could turn into a scandal?
Whole story on Twitter. Yeah, no. We had been, Mike and I had been in a meeting, and we walk out, and like, this is all over our phones, and we're like, what? Back up. But yeah.
The news being that...
That Secretary DeVos was set to resign imminently, and it really did...
Was what was reported.
Right.
Not
or
true.
It was on a... Very not true. A bunch of Politics K-12, U.S. News and World, Politico, BuzzFeed, everyone really pushed back on that, but...
Betsy DeVos is still in the building.
Still in the building. Planning
and
on sticking around for 4 years.
And the Politico article sort of said as much. It said that, you know, probably won't actually leave.
Yeah. I mean, I thought the Politico profile on Secretary DeVos was really well done.
Mm-hmm.
And there just hasn't been a whole lot of journalism or in-depth coverage about her background, where she came from, how she approaches this work, and really what her feelings are about, you know, now 10 months into the job, how she's finding it.
Yeah.
And so I thought they did a really great job just sort of helping me and hopefully others like better understand the way that she approaches the work and how she's been thinking about it and good or bad, the things that she's found since coming to DC and trying to work with the career staff and others at the Department of Ed.
Yeah. And I think one thing that was, you know, clear in the profile and really if, you know, for those of us who pay attention to education reform and read the tea leaves and do departmentology, is that she was always planning on being here for the entirety of the administration, the first term at least. But B, like one of the things that she was really going to kind of advance and champion is kind of right-sizing, in quotation marks, the department and kind of scaling back its scope from where it was in the Obama years. And also she thought, you know, it's a bureaucracy and it's big and it's inefficient. And I think that's been kind of one of the challenges is like understanding like what the bureaucracy does. And in you lived inside the bureaucracy for a couple of years. And what are some of the challenges that if you're coming in and, you know, Mike was in the Bush department and he will talk a lot about, you know, the processes and the procedures and just it was very cumbersome to work with sometimes. And that's one of the challenges that he ran into. But what are some of the things that as you're entering and you're like, listen, this is a huge bureaucracy. It's pretty inefficient. Let's scale it back. Like, what are some of the challenges that you're going to immediately run into?
I think one of the basic challenges is that there actually is just a ton of work to be done, even to just keep the trains running. The department has a huge budget, you know, administers really critical programs, whether it's ESSA or IDEA, all the civil rights enforcement, plus student loans. I mean, that's,
yeah.
You're running a bank. Like, it's a huge undertaking and much more complicated and complex, I think, particularly if you're coming to this from, like Secretary DeVos is, mostly thinking about K-12 and not necessarily thinking about some of the other things the department does, whether it's in higher education or the civil rights enforcement. So I think that that's an immediate challenge. Just, you know, even if you're not thinking about how do I implement this cool new thing or this new priority mm-hmm. I have, just keeping the trains running, making sure that all that money is being spent appropriately and that you're not, you know, wasting or misusing taxpayer dollars is really important. I mean, also right now, at least, the department is still in the midst of implementing a huge new K-12 education mm-hmm. law. They're reviewing 51, 52, actually, with Puerto Rico mm-hmm. state plans. And that's a huge undertaking right now that requires a lot of staff capacity and
just
time
to like read and process and get through.
And it's especially true because this scaling down of the agency isn't just about staff. It's also about, right, sort of the scope of their work, which includes the regulations that have been passed mm-hmm. and now repealed. And when Congress was going through this process and wrote about this, I wrote about it too, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
that there's a lot of danger and risk in repealing these things. And a big reason for that is the administrative state has grown to serve a very important function, which is to take very intentionally ambiguous laws and clarify them and actually, in that sense, make law. And they are deferred to by the Supreme Court. It mm-hmm. is part of their role. Laws through the process are, as I said, intentionally vague. And when you don't pass any regulations at all, which is the current state under ESSA, there are just no regulations. It's just the law. Then you run into a lot of confusion, which actually happened with the first round of ESSA plans, right? The staff seemed to sort of take a different route than maybe DeVos had publicly indicated. Then they pulled back on it. And then the danger there, right, is that it's possible that you aren't enforcing or aren't clarifying, you know, important mm-hmm. provisions in the law. Connor Williams has talked a lot about this with sort of civil rights mm-hmm. protections and protections of
ELL students.
Right, usually. Right. And and that's a problem, not only in the Department of Education, but in sort of agencies across the country as they're following this sort of new model.
Okay, but if you're, you know, Secretary DeVos, and I think Mike's predicted, and a lot of people have also predicted, that it's not going to be a sort of the Obama department. Like, one could say it's pretty activist. It was getting into a lot of different areas that this Department of Education normally hadn't gotten into. It was making a lot of decisions around discipline on the K-12 level. It was kind of getting involved there on the higher ed level. Sexual assault and harassment on campus became a huge deal over the last 8 years. And if you're going to say, like, okay, like, you know, the department expanded to fill this space, now, like, my scope and my vision is this, and it's a more narrow scope, like, is there anything that you can really do once the department has grown to go back and right size it?
So I don't think that the issue, though, is staffing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think if you look at the numbers of employees at the U.S. Mm-hmm. Department of Education, that didn't necessarily bloom and grow infinitely under the Obama okay. administration. I think it really was more about the scope of maybe some of the guidance that was being issued.
Mm-hmm.
Just simply the fact that there was all this new money through the stimulus going into education meant that there mm-hmm. were a lot of new programs and new initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've already seen this some with this new regulatory review commission
mm-hmm.
that Secretary DeVos, you know, and the White House have been promoting as a way to strip back some of the guidance that was issued on civil rights.
The 72 regulations that were kind of pulled off the books a couple of weeks
guidance
ago.
Guidance documents.
Sorry.
Yes. So, but they are making moves on the regulatory front too.
Mm-hmm.
So in higher education, the gainful employment rule, the borrower defense rule, these sort of wonky protections mm-hmm. for students that have perhaps been defrauded by their colleges or, you know, didn't have, you know, took out all these student loans and then weren't able to pay them back because they couldn't find jobs.
Right.
Similarly, on the special ed front, there was a rule that was issued late in the Obama administration around disproportionate identification of mm-hmm. students for special education.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been some discussion about whether the department will announce that it's going to propose to rescind that rule.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's, you know, probably an easier path, actually, to reining back what you would call the administrative state, Brandon, is going after regs, going after guidance. Mm-hmm. And then with staffing, I think the key question is, like, can you actually not just sort of, I think you'll see attrition through retirements, attrition mm-hmm. through people who just said, you know, this, I really believed in what the past administration does, but this not feeling this so much.
Yeah.
So maybe you'll just see some mobility over time. And then can you actually move staff around within the department? So if Secretary DeVos really wants to focus on school choice, that would say, like, I want to staff up the Office of Innovation,
mm-hmm.
because that's where they're really doing a lot of work around charter schools, magnet mm-hmm. programs.
Getting stuff started.
So how can you be nimble with the staff that you have? And that's actually more of a challenge, too, within any, you know, federal agency, is moving folks within the department as well.
Mm-hmm. So I think what you're talking about, and I totally agree, right? And I'll put on my sort of Fordham center right hat here.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's probably true that the administrative state or a lot of federal agencies are, you know, kind of bloated and maybe inefficient and could sort of become more inefficient and more sort of, you know, I don't know, efficiently or properly sized. But
mm-hmm.
I think the way to do that is to sort of take a chisel to things like Anne talked about and not sort of take a sledgehammer and just, you know,
we're no longer doing X.
Right. Like, right. Take a bunch of jobs and just don't fill them, even though they sort of are designed to be filled, or just, you know, take a ton of rags and just throw them in the garbage, even though they're actually, you know, currently doing things.
Mm-hmm.
I agree that there is some signs that they're going about it in mm-hmm. in a thoughtful way, but I just want to.
Yeah,
it's tricky. And I think one of the things too that is a challenge maybe within the Department of Education that it isn't in, you know, say the Department of Defense, is the idea of like, what specifically does the department do? And that's hard to articulate for, I think, anyone. You know, when we were having the debates around the confirmation hearing, like I'd have talks with friends who even, you know, they might work in education, they might be teachers, they might be outside of education. And you'd ask them to sort of list their frustrations or whatever. And they were very valid, but they weren't things that were controlled by the Department of Education. It's the state board, it's their superintendent, it's a governor sometimes. And I think that kind of amorphous nature of what the department can and cannot do and how people understand that is probably also a challenge when you're thinking about like, okay, like what is our vision and what is our scope for this administrative agency?
Totally. I mean, and speaking from someone that worked in the Obama administration, worked with Secretary mm-hmm. Duncan and Secretary King, I'm certainly concerned by some of the things that have mm-hmm. been repealed and pulled back, particularly around civil rights. I'm sure I have some disagreements with my Fordham friends on that. And it's just something to watch for. You know, I think that mm-hmm. is a critical reason of why the department exists. It is to protect student civil rights, mm-hmm. whether that's transgender students, whether that's LGBTQ students, you know, all of that is really important. All the Title IX stuff. I think that there are a lot of complicated issues for getting that right and balancing what the federal role should be with what, you know, schools, colleges and universities need to right. be doing, and listening to all constituencies on that. But it's certainly something that I'm concerned about. I'm less concerned about, you know, taking outdated guidance documents that are 10 years old off totally. The website.
It's yeah. important.
Like, that's a really good, thing yeah. to do. It just like clarifies what currently is best practice, where, you mm-hmm. know, and to sort of streamline and just make sure that we aren't bloated in the sense of the number yeah. of things that we're sending out. You want yeah. to send a consistent signal.
Yeah, and it's probably confusing if something that was best practice 12 years ago is still on the website and you're trying to find information about what you should do today regarding an issue.
Yeah.
Totally.
Anyways, TLDR, it's complicated, it's confusing, and it's been an interesting week in Department of Education-ology. I kind of like that. Criminology, Department of Education-ology.
Ed-ology?
Ed-ology. We'll go with that. All right, but that's all the time we have for Ed Reform Update. Thank you so much, Anne.
Thanks for having me. It was great yeah. to be here.
Always. And up next, everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. And we're back. Welcome to the show, Amber.
Thanks, Alyssa.
Right now, Mike didn't let me talk about this last week because he didn't watch it. But do you watch Stranger Things?
I do not.
Ah,
the only
guys.
Thing I watch on TV is This Is Us. And it's like that kind of... Like,
no spoilers. I haven't watched the season yet. Please.
And we can't talk about This
so
Is Us.
I loved it so much last season.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, my God. We can't talk about This Is Us. But I highly recommend Stranger Things if you are a fan.
You are like the 50th person that said it. Like, so just give me like a quick little overview of what it's all about.
It's like little middle school kids. And there's like weird forces.
Yes, oh. It's a.
But it's like 80s nostalgia.
There's
so like
a lot
it takes
of
place in the 80s.
It's just it's very well acted. It's
so they have superpowers, or
there's one kid with superpowers. And it's obviously there's a government conspiracy involved.
Oh, right.
There's a lot of ET and Spielberg homages, stuff like that.
Oh, and it's a lot of throwbacks to classic like 80s movies.
It's if you liked 80s movies, which I didn't watch enough of them to develop an opinion because my movie knowledge is terrible, but like it's still funny and like there's a lot of just callbacks and the kid actors especially are like very talented.
And like phones on the wall with long cords and stuff like that, you know?
Yes. Cool. Yes. They've done some funny like interviews about how they had to teach children like, no, like this is how you used to dial touch tone phones right. because they were born in like 2005 or whatever.
All right. But, good enough plug. I'll check it out.
Yes. And anyways, this is the education podcast, not the pop culture podcast. So what do you got for us this week?
We have a new study out in the AEFP Journal by David Blazar that examines whether teachers have impacts on student outcomes other than test scores. This is all the rage, right?
Mm.
Including students' self-reported behavior in class, self-efficacy in math, and how happy they feel in class.
Oh, so it's not like stand and deliver, but like
not
long-term
really.
Outcomes. Right. Okay.
Short-term
movies.
Stuff.
Okay.
And then he compares the effects on these other outcomes to their effects on teachers' test scores as well.
Okay.
So the study collects data from fourth and fifth grade teachers in four anonymous school districts in three states on the East Coast. So, that doesn't tell us a ton, right? Across three school years from 2010-11 through 2012-13, they focus on a subset of 41 teachers who are part of a random assignment study in year three, and a group of students and their teachers who complete this survey that I just told you about that ask them all this stuff.
Okay.
Analysts also had access to student demographic, achievement data, teacher value-added data, student survey data on three constructs. Like I already told you, behavior, self-efficacy, and happiness. Anyway, I was looking for the actual survey because I thought, like, what exactly did they ask these kids? But it was not in the appendix, just FYI.
Okay.
Regarding the causal nature of the study, in the spring of 2012, these fourth and fifth grade teachers were randomly assigned to class rosters of the same grade level. And just little note, they were generalists. So in other words, they had the kids for every subject. So you don't have the problem here where these effects might be confounded with the effect of another teacher.
If one is ELA and one is math.
Self-contained.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, findings. Number one, teachers had substantial impact on all three self-reported measures of student attitudes and behavior. The largest of these was on student happiness in class, where a 1 standard deviation increase in teacher effectiveness led to a roughly 0.30 standard deviation increase in happiness. Further, the magnitude of teacher effects on behavior in class and self-efficacy in math, those two other things, were generally larger than teachers' effects on the student's math performance. But again, they were smaller than the teacher effect on student happiness. Okay. Second, and this is the one that you kind of saw in the newspaper. It was Matt Barnum, I think, that had it in chalkboard. And this is what he highlighted. There was a small but negative relationship between teacher effects on student math performance and teacher effects on happiness in class. So it suggested that teachers who were skilled at boosting math achievement may do so in ways that make students less happy or less engaged. But that's not to say, I was looking at it, it was pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not to say that teachers can't increase student scores and increase student happiness in class. But it is kind of curious because when you think about it, we have a ton of studies on teacher impact, right, on test scores. And at least one, the Raj Chetty and some other ones, have found that these teacher impacts on tests have been positively related to longer-term outcomes like college entry, college completion, higher wages.
All the good stuff.
So it's kind of a curious finding, honestly. But again, it's short-term, so I don't put as much stock in it. Anyway, analysts close by saying that student survey data on outcomes like these aren't good for official accountability systems. I think we pretty much know that right now, don't we? They can certainly inform, however, where teachers might need additional PD, perhaps, or whether they need some peer coaching on, you know, because their kids are constantly saying they're unhappy or they don't have confidence in how they do math or something like that. And they say we need to do better, gathering richer measures on these other non-cognitive outcomes, which I think everybody's saying that too. So I don't think there was anything terribly like, you know, earth shattering in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the small negative finding that's showing that if you boost test scores and your kids say they're unhappy, people's attention, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So just so I'm clear, they're saying that the teacher, him or herself, impacted the kid's happiness, not the teacher's efficacy. So like, it's not like the better a teacher is, the happier a child is. It's just like a teacher's personality.
The teachers are randomly assigned. So whatever impact of that teacher, and it's really hard to like pull it apart, right, as to what's going on here. But whatever impact that's sort of nested within that teacher is what was the causal mechanism that was saying that that students were unhappy, you know? So it was, I don't know if that answers your question, but in other words,
the question I'm trying to ask is, are students of teachers who are, so if their test scores are going up, are there, is their happiness going up?
Going down.
Okay.
Their right. happiness is going down. It's an inverse relationship.
Okay. Right.
And if the test scores are going down, they're getting happier?
Yeah. You know what? That's, I'm not exactly sure the magnitude of that, right? Because when they talked about the different, when they looked at the three constructs, mm-hmm. they kind of set it in like cascading order. And the magnitude on some of those other ones was pretty small. So it's hard to kind of parse, right? What, how much everything is sort of contributing to these various types of engagement. I think when I was looking at it, though, the one thing that they were kind of making a bigger deal out of was that these are all fairly small. And I think that's the biggest thing to keep in mind. You know, when we start trying to make a bigger deal out of like, mm-hmm. well, how, you know, how big was the magnitude? And when you start looking at it, that the numbers are just so tiny to begin with.
Yeah. So it's important to, you know, keep in perspective, but also good to kind of just better yeah. understand the impact of the teachers.
And
in
I mean,
the classroom.
I think because what I said earlier, because these are short term, you know, these aren't longer term impacts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's literally, they did this in 1 year. It was year three in this evaluation in a small number of districts. And so they're not tracking these things long term. I don't know. I guess, I mean, I get it's an AEFP, but it was such a small bump and it occurred over such a small amount of time. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So, and they weren't able to speculate as to what the qualities in these teachers that were producing more happiness
That's right.
was.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, they have.
But I guess how do they know that these effects weren't just random noise?
Well, it's a causal. I mean, you know, okay. it's a causal. And there's about 15 pages of sensitivity and robust checks.
So this could be like the non-researcher in me, though. But if they don't know what mechanisms are causing the increase, how do they know that those mechanisms are causing the increase if they don't know what the mechanisms are?
Well, if it's a Does causal study, I mean, you can't really figure out like, because it's better than a study where you're just kind of controlling for prior achievement, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're just saying, okay, we're going to control for prior achievement, you still have a gazillion other things it could be.
Sure.
At least in a random assignment study, like whatever those random other things could be are evenly distributed across, you know, students and in schools. And
okay.
Right. So at least there, you know, the bar of what you're able to say is more rigorous than if you're just simply okay. controlling for prior achievement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, I mean, you guys know these random assignment studies are exceedingly rare, especially mm-hmm. when we're looking at like, you know, non-cognitive outcomes to allow, you know, for school districts to basically buy in and say, we'll allow our teachers to be randomly assigned to rosters of students. Kind of a big deal.
Yeah, and they're yeah. expensive to undertake and stuff like that.
And as a researcher yourself, this would be more interesting if these teachers who are producing greater levels of happiness produce that effect over more years.
Yeah, or they actually showed that indicator where students are saying, you know, yes, I'm happier, that also was correlated to something else that we care about later, okay. you know, whether it's entry into college or just something. But, you know, we often see these surveys where you see little bumps, mm-hmm. you know, happen a year later and then they kind of disappear. Same thing we see with Head Start where you get these fade out things and you're like, okay, does this really mean anything or just some random bump like we see when we introduce new accountability system, like pick your intervention. You normally, when you introduce a change, you see a bump, you know, and a short-term bump that usually might just disappear.
Yeah. There's a ton of talk right now about A, student surveys and B, student happiness and also obviously long-term outcomes. So an interesting, I think, add to that canon and that narrative that we're building around that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I noticed that Marty West and some other people that are really trying to get at how do we measure some of these non-cognitive impact gave advice on the mm-hmm. study. And there were a bunch of other people that were serving as advisors. So, I mean, it made me feel really confident that we've got a growing number of really top-notch scholars who are interested in this topic and trying to get it right. So
very cool. But that's all the time we have for the Research Minute this week. Thank you so much, Amber.
Thank you.
And that's actually all the time we have for the Education Gadfly Show, too. So until next time.
Right.
And I'm Alyssa Schwenk for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.